Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, I'm Trish Halpin.
And I'm Lorraine Candy.
Welcome to Postcards from Midlife, the show where we help you through the midlife, the menopause, motherhood, and everything in between.
In today's episode, we're going to be separating menopause myths from reality and finding out what is actually going on with our hormones in perimenopause.
And tactics on rowing with your teenager, all those family arguments you tend to have with hormonal teens, where you can get help, and what's really going on if you're feeling at the end of your tether.
Have you been feeling at the end of your tether, Lorraine?
Yes. Sleeping.
I know we talk about this a bit, but
well,
sleeping.
It's a big thing, midlife and sleeping. Do you know what I discovered this week, which I think is going to be the way forward for me and Mr. Candy? The Scandinavian to duvet. You each have a duvet and you cocoon, that's the word they use.
That sounds very cozy.
In your own, at your own pace, without having it pulled off you or without his hugely volcanic heat radiating. So I'm going to get a duvet each and then that's going to regulate my own heat without having to moan to Mr. Candy about it. So that's my plan.
So
you've
my
got
plan.
A thing,
I've got
haven't
you? Well, I,
special
I'll
war
tell you
zone
what I
in
did.
Your bed. What do you do, Trish? Tell
I
me
did,
about
I
it.
I bought a super king size bed. You know, Neil and I, we're not the biggest people in the world, so there's actually quite a lot of space to have on this bed. And in fact, there's a sort of barrier down the middle of the bed where I stuff my extra pillow.
Is that because rampant Neil? Is it that?
It's just more that it's just like my own cocoon space. But we
Why
do
you
share
just get your own bed.
My sugar duke. We do share a duvet though, so that's you know. That's,
what's the barricade for? Because he
it's
snores.
It's more like
moves.
No. Do you know what? I like to rest my arm on it.
Oh my
so
God.
I've got one of these memory foam pillows that's sculpted to the shape of your head, so you don't move. You just lie on your back. You don't really toss and turn all night. It's so comfortable. And then I just like to rest my arm on the extra pillow at the side.
This is why we would be very bad bed companions. I know this about you. There's many reasons why we would be bad bed companions, but I sleep on my front in a sort of star shape.
Ah, selfish starfish. You
yes.
need a super king size bed.
No, I know.
No.
Need my own bed.
You just need a big single bed.
Yes.
Your own queen bed.
Yeah,
that'd be nice.
Now, our special guest today is Dr. Shazadi Harper, who runs the Harper Clinic in London. She's a member of the British Menopause Society, and she's a specialist in perimenopause and menopause. She also has a daughter. She's 49. She has quite a good, helpful personal story to tell. Welcome to Postcards from Midlife. I think we'd like to start really by clarifying some medical things, because that's your area of expertise. So talk to me about the perimenopause, because this is the big bit that I didn't understand, didn't know about. So all your symptoms of menopause, as it were, are in that period leading up to when your periods stop. And all we talk about is when your periods stop, and that's the menopause. So what happens and what treatment can we look for?
Well, thank you for having me here. It's great to be here. So yeah, people hear that term menopause and they just don't know what it means that time leading up to it. So we know that the average age of menopause in this country is 51. Okay?
That's when your periods stop.
That's when your periods stop. So what the menopause means is it's your last period. But you can only say that a year afterwards. So when you've had a year of no period, you can look back and say, oh, that's when my menopause happened. And the average age in this country for that is 51.
Right.
And that time leading up to it is called the perimenopause. And that can be 4 to 8 years. But on average, again, most women sort of dive into it at the age of 47 and a half. But I have to give a few caveats to that, really, because I think, you know, we talk about menopause, and I think sometimes we need to understand, and here we are in London, very cosmopolitan, very international, lots of different ethnicities. So lots of factors can actually affect that average age. If you're a woman of Southeast Asian origin, i.e. sort of Indian, Pakistani, it could be 46 and a half. If you're a woman who's not had any children, it could be 2 years earlier. If you are a woman who's had children under the age of 28, it can be 2 years earlier.
Do you think there's a lot of myths and misconceptions? Do you see with women who come to your clinic just a sort of a lack of understanding? Because I know I really didn't understand what was happening to me at that time.
Especially the emotional side of it, because those are symptoms. And this is the issue, isn't it? There isn't a blood test that says you're perimenopausal.
No.
There isn't one that says you are menopausal.
No.
And all these other symptoms, loss of concentration, loss
feeling
of libido,
overwhelmed.
Overwhelmed. And actually, proper diagnosable depression, extreme exhaustion, chronic tiredness, night sweats, not being able to, all of this is part of it, isn't it?
I think when women enter into their 40s, or women in general, I think we're so used to just putting up with things and dealing with things, and we kind of put it down to life, you know, maybe children, partners, work, you know, all of those kind of factors. So I think sometimes these symptoms of perimenopause can come along and you're not sort of putting two and two together. You're feeling tired, but you might think, oh, it's because I'm doing a school run or my children are going off to university.
Well, your GP's not putting two and two together.
No, that's also the case. Now, GPs don't put two and two together. And I think that, you know, some women are kind of left sort of searching and wondering what's going on. And a lot of women, you know, you mentioned about sort of mood, emotional sort of side of things. They're not really aware that their mood could be affected by their hormones. And women who've not experienced anxiety before in the past suddenly feel anxious or are waking up with palpitations.
I had a panic attack.
Yeah. I mean, similarly, for myself, you know, I've never been a non-coping kind of woman. I'm a big sister. You know, I'm always the one that they turn to.
Can we just stop at big sister? Because you have 7 siblings?
I do.
6 sisters?
5 sisters and 2 brothers. And so I'm their big sister. So I'm the one that they turn to. And obviously the hormonal changes affect me before any of them. And suddenly I'm feeling anxious or feeling a bit more overwhelmed.
When did that start for you?
For me, I think it was more like 44, 45. You know, so it's been a few years. And
I've got friends who have been suicidal with the symptoms and have thought that something, they might have schizophrenia and they might have some awful mental illness, and actually it's the decreasing in estrogen, testosterone.
It's all of those hormones declining. And you sort of mentioned, you know, what are these myths? And I think a lot of the time women think it must be much older women. You know, you've got to be maybe in your 50s or 60s. And I've had a number of patients, and one in particular stands out at 47. And she actually only came because one of her friends almost like pushed her to come and see me. And her friend was 51 or 52. We went through and I said, I think you're perimenopausal. I mean, I thought, I know you are, but you know, you have to sort of tailor it to her. And she said she actually felt quite angry. She felt really angry that she hadn't been prepared for this stage of her life, and nobody seemed to have told her about it. Nobody seemed to have warned her, I suppose.
I had exactly that experience probably in my mid-40s. Overwhelmed, anxious, can't cope with anything, tearful all the time. I went to see a therapist. I didn't even think about going to my GP. Yeah. I thought, this is something, I need therapy. I don't need...
Well, you thought it was your fault.
But I just, you know, I'm a journalist. I should have been able to know about this and find out about it.
Well, so when you say
it's clearly
that,
a bigger society. We just don't talk about it. We don't...
Oh, look, you say that about yourself, but I'm a doctor, and I think when these symptoms started to happen to me, you know, at the same time I was in a new relationship, you know, my daughter was going to be doing her GCSEs, I didn't think it was my hormones, and yet this is my sort of field. And it took me a little bit of time to put together this sort of overwhelming fatigue that I was experiencing, suddenly getting up in the night to go to the toilet. And I thought, what's going on there? Isn't that what old men do, not me? And again, it's all about the estrogen.
So talking about hormones, can you just get a little bit scientific here and actually explain what is happening to our hormones and what kind of effect does that have on us, other than some of these symptoms, such as our sex drive, those kind of things?
So our female hormones are estrogen and progesterone. They're produced from our ovaries, And we also produce some testosterone. And so what happens from our sort of 40s onwards is our ovaries aren't working as well, or they're not producing those hormones in the same kind of quantities as they were before.
Because we don't need them, is that what? Yeah.
Well, it's a decline in fertility. I suppose, yes, we don't need them as much. But we do need them for other parts of our body. And I think everybody assumes that we're just our ovaries. But I often say women are more than just their ovaries. And those estrogen receptors are in our brain. You know, they affect our collagen, you know, our skin, our hair.
Someone described it to me as it's like a car engine and there's all the oil making it work. And then the oil just starts to disappear and stuff starts getting a bit cranky. And
you know, that's a great, properly. That's actually a great analogy, because one of the symptoms is joint stiffness.
I thought I had arthritis at 40, ridiculous.
Yeah, and that again is because we haven't got as much estrogens. Actually, the higher number of women will get that symptom compared to hot flushes, which we all seem to know about. Hot flushes or being a bit cranky and irritable and moody, you know, those are the things that we get labelled with, I think.
And it's also, this is my pet theory on this, because people like to make fun of women when there's things wrong with them, and you can do 1,000 cartoons about people, women having hot flushes, but you can't about women having serious things like joint aching, which men might get, but they don't get hot flushes, so it's funny. And we actually make it funny ourselves, the feminist aside. I just think it's a stupid thing to do, to make it funny.
It really is. I had a woman who used to work on BMW, because I'm from Oxford, so when I was in Oxford at BMW plant, and she was on the production line, and she was getting hot flushes every 20 minutes and having to walk away. And it's a very male-dominated environment. So, you know, it is really embarrassing for her, very awkward, you know.
Yeah, it's not funny at all. It's actually really debilitating. And what do you, so you go into your GP and you say, this is it, this is awful, I'm having, as I did, I'm having peculiar panic attacks, never happened to me before, I feel very anxious, can't sleep, very hot all the time. What should you be asking your GP for, and how should you ask? Because you're also a bit odd when you go in, I think, you're a bit, you can't quite absorb information.
Yeah. I've been a GP, and I also know from the other side, you know, being a more inexperienced GP, probably 10 years ago, that when these kind of women used to come in, I used to think, what is going on with them? You know, I don't know much about it. And that's because GPs don't get much training at all.
GPs get very little training. So you can't, I don't want to feel like we're blaming GPs all the time, but it's because they aren't given the information that's needed, and there's a lot more available now.
So I think when you go into your GP surgery, I think, you know, you talk about it, you need to express what's going on, and maybe say, look, I don't think I'm depressed, because there is something called menopause mood disorder. And that doesn't mean to say you're depressed, as it would be described in normal medical terms. And I think, you know, you really need a bit of time with your GP. So maybe not just walk away after one appointment, maybe make a double appointment.
Good point. Should you write down?
I would say write them down, because you've got 10 minutes, and actually you've got probably a bit less than that. So if you write it down and you can go in. In my practice in Oxford with my other partners, I used to give them a menopause symptom checker, that if a woman came in, is to hand it over to them so she could go home and almost do a bit of homework before she came to see you. So I would say to some women, look, if you're not sure what's going on, maybe do a little bit of homework if you can, or at least write it down, so that when you're there, because maybe your GP won't know what's going on, that you can almost try and direct the conversation a little bit.
And do you think women might be reticent to talk about more intimate things like sex drive or vaginal dryness, those kind of issues?
I think they're very reticent. But I also think that when they come and see you, often it's the lowest priority for some of them. You know, if they're not sleeping, if they're getting hot flushes, if they're feeling depressed, you know, if they're feeling low in mood, if their joints are aching. And often, you know, I will directly ask that question about vaginal dryness and libido, and they'll say, yeah, maybe a bit dry. Well, I've not had sex for a while. I don't really feel like it. But that's because they've got so many other things going on, because they're tired. And they'll say, you know, that's not what's worrying me. But then on another level, I often have some women come in and that's their driving force. And I had one woman who said to me, I don't want my relationship with my husband to be like a brother and sister.
No.
And that's where it's going.
Boring.
You know, and that's where it's going. And, you know, and sex is healthy, you know, for your vaginal health, for your mood, for intimacy,
we've talked to Susie Gosson, haven't we? It's part of being in love as well.
Absolutely.
You can't say that's the end of it just because you're over 40. So you're in your GP and you say, what about HRT? Is it going to give me breast cancer? I can't take it, can I, because of the scare stories?
Yeah, I mean, this infuriates me, you know, and it's one of these myths that we're talking about. when it comes to breast cancer. I think that we hear so much about it, and you know, I think sometimes it's the media, the way that they portray it, that HRT causes breast cancer. But there are other things that we need to weigh up. You know, I can't say to you 100% it doesn't have, you know, it doesn't.
There is a small risk attached, isn't
there? There is a small risk, but there are bigger risks attached with smoking.
Or
with
drinking wine.
Drinking.
I think, what's the figure? If you drink wine, 2 glasses of wine a day, your risk is more than taking HRT.
Yeah, and smoking and obesity. You know, when women go into this, when they're in their perimenopause, one of the things they also say is they gain weight. So should we not be helping them to get that energy, that motivation to help them lose that weight? Mm. You know, lowering your weight will actually lower your risk factors for so many illnesses, diseases, you know, sort of.
HRT, as far as I understand it from the research I've done and the pieces we've done in the magazine, it can protect you from osteoporosis.
Oh, it does.
Dementia.
Yeah.
And a variety of other cardiovascular disease.
Yeah.
So there are real benefits beyond just the treatment of your perimenopause.
And that's why, you know, you really need to talk to somebody about the whole picture, because it is cardioprotective. It does protect your heart. You know, when it comes to bones, when 1 in 2 women will suffer with osteoporosis, and HRT is the best treatment for it. And, you know, one of the big reasons I came into this field also is my mother got dementia, and it was really following the menopause that things all went a bit pear-shaped for her. And for me, you know, my brain is my biggest asset, well, and I don't want to lose that.
Your mum had 8 children. I mean, that must have been she must have been extraordinarily exhausted as
so
well.
How do people stay on HRT? Because I'm one of these people. Unfortunately, my mother died of breast cancer. I hadn't even considered taking HRT, so I've sort of done my perimenopause without anything apart from some therapy, very expensive therapy.
Me, Trish, I've been here.
Is it still advisable to kind of, if you had your menopause?
Ignored that.
Can you go on HRT after you've had your menopause?
The NICE guidelines say that you can start on HRT within 10 years of your menopause. Okay.
Right.
And you know, one of the things is you can even go on to it at a later point if you discuss it with a doctor and you weigh up the risks and the benefits for you. I was reading that Liz Earle's mum at the age of 80 just recently has gone on to HRT. Oh, wow. May well be for her bones, may well be for other symptoms. But, you know, I do have some women who are 72, 73, 79, 80 who are on it. So you have to weigh up the risks for each person. You know, if you are a smoker and you're overweight and, you know, you've got positive history of breast cancer, I'm not going to put you onto it. But talking about breast cancer, just because in your family there's breast cancer doesn't mean to say you can't go on to it. If you've not got the BRCA gene, then you could still, you know, go on to HRT. And if you've not had an estrogen receptor breast cancer, you can still have vaginal estrogens as well. So I think, you know, there are a lot of myths out there when it comes to breast cancer and who can or can't go on to HRT.
You mentioned the that's one method through vaginal HRT.
Yeah.
What other methods are there? How do people take it?
So HRT can be taken as gels, patches, tablets, and also as pessaries. You know, the progesterone can be given as a pessary. I personally like to do it through the skin, you know, using a gel, and I like to give micronized progesterone, which are both very naturally produced from yams and is what we call body identical.
Right, Shazadi, I'm going to ask you the question everyone asks me. This is the one our readers ask on the Sunday Times. It's one me and Trish debate quite a lot.
Okay.
So I have been prescribed body identical HRT. This is what the NHS prescribes.
Yeah, yeah.
I have friends who are on bio-identical HRT.
Yes.
They've gone to private clinics. They've had a blood test, which has revealed they need this specific bespoke makeup of HRT. Now, it's unregulated and it's expensive.
Yeah,
and I don't think they should be taking that, but they seem to feel that it's offering a kind of a real solution because it's a very bespoke thing, because it's based on a blood test. Now, we know the blood test element is a bit of a red herring. Can you just unpick that as a medical expert for us?
Yeah, I mean, I think the other thing to remember is body identical, and the reason we use that term, and I also prescribe that, is it's actually regulated bioidentical. So, and bioidentical, all that means is chemically similar to what your body produces. So we don't use that term bioidentical, I suppose, in the NHS and, you know, in clinics such as mine, because we want to separate and differentiate it between the bioidentical market, these clinics where a lot of money is spent on blood tests and a lot of money is spent on making it seem bespoke, because they say it's from a specially made formulation for you rather than for you, Trish. Whereas actually, one of the things is they don't seem to tend to work. And, you know, they're not regulated. They haven't got that evidence behind it. So I will often say, and I will often see women who've been there and, you know, who are still symptomatic because they spent a lot of money on it. And I
it's
think
it's thousands, isn't it? It's not just, you know, thousands. A couple of hundred here and there. It's thousands of pounds.
And I think that's why probably they might be thinking that it's doing them good. I think it's a great marketing job. That's what I think it is.
Now, the other thing that is confusing is the blood test element of this. So as I understand it, having got my journalist head on when I've been in doctor's surgeries, if you have a blood test now, if I have a blood test today, the results tomorrow around hormones will be very different from my blood test today. But there's no benchmark, there's no baseline of what my actual hormones were when they were all firing on all cylinders when I was 30. So you haven't got that, you can't compare to that, so you can't prescribe to that, and it could be different tomorrow. That's kind of how, is that right?
Yeah, and that's why the numbers aren't as important as you. And I think we need
symptoms
to understand that.
Symptoms are important.
Yeah, so, you know, if you, the NICE guidelines say, if you're over the age of 45 and you've got symptoms, then forget the numbers. You know, treat the woman, treat you, treat your symptoms. And you're right, you know, if you are perimenopausal and you go in one day, your blood test, which is the FSH, follicle stimulating hormone test, that could be perfectly normal today, but yet you could be feeling, you know, a lot of perimenopausal symptoms. But then if you repeat it again, and that is what you're meant to do, is repeat it again in 6 weeks' time, it could be very different. And it can vary and fluctuate because that's exactly what's going on in the perimenopause. Your hormones are fluctuating and they're gradually declining. So the blood test is not an accurate indication of what's going on. The only time it's useful is if you've got a Mirena coil fitted, which is a progesterone-only coil, if you've got Depo, which is a progesterone-only implant, or if you're on the mini pill. So that's the only time that it's important because your symptoms may be masked because on those forms of contraception, you may not know when your periods have stopped or irregular because a lot of women don't get periods on that.
Now, can we talk about progesterone as well? Because I also take progesterone tablets. So the two, HRT and progesterone, are often prescribed in tandem, aren't they? What is progesterone doing? So is it my womb lining?
Yes. So if you've got an intact womb, then we've got to, if you were just given estrogen alone, then the lining of your womb would just keep building and building and building and put you at risk of endometrial cancer. So what progesterone does, it sort of counterbalances that and prevents you from getting that over-thickened lining of your womb.
Right.
Progesterone can also help with sort of anti-anxiety type symptoms and help with sleep type symptoms as well.
Oh, can it?
It works in what we call the GABA receptors in the brain to help sort of calming. Not all women like it. If you've had PMT, it's not your favourite hormone. I'm a PMT sufferer. It's not my favourite hormone. So often for those women, I will say to them to maybe use it or take it as a pessary rather than taking it orally because there'll be less of a general effect.
And talking about, you were talking before about contraceptives.
Yeah.
I have no clue about HRT and contraceptives. How do they interact? I mean, you can still get pregnant during your perimenopause, is that correct?
Yeah, I mean, HRT is not contraception.
No.
And I need to say that because I think a lot of women forget that and there are sort of, they get pregnant and there are increasing rates of terminations and things in the over 40 age group, actually. So you do need contraception in the perimenopause. And the rule of thumb is if you are under the age of 50 and your periods have stopped, you need to have contraception for 2 more years. If you're over the age of 50 and your periods have stopped, you need contraception for 1 more year. And if you are a woman who's got the coil and, you know, one of these contraceptions that I've mention, then you should continue until the age of 55. You know, all women can basically stop contraception at 55 because it's highly, highly, highly unlikely that you will get pregnant.
I made my husband have a vasectomy.
Yeah, great idea.
And now everybody knows.
Well, I wrote about it in a newspaper at the time.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, it's a great idea.
Well, I've just thought,
So do they have, because obviously contraception, you know, the pill, it's hormonal, isn't it? So do they have to balance out the HRT, type of HRT they give you with that?
Well, no. I mean, HRT is usually a much lower dose than any of your pills. So often women who may want to what they may want to do is have the transdermal estrogen and have a Mirena coil. And that way you get your progesterone to protect the lining of your womb as well as having contraception.
Mm-hmm.
Or people use condoms.
God, you really need to see... No, condoms, go and see a doctor who knows about this, don't you?
You do. Like you. But you sort of have to do a bit of research before you go, because I think you go, you're quite desperate by the time you go, so you can't take it all in.
Yeah.
When, now, the other thing that I think is interesting about your story, Shazadi, is your mum.
Yeah.
Because you've said before that the way your mum or our mums have gone through menopause may be an indicator of what we're going to go through as well. So how did it work with your mum? How did you tackle that?
So we grew up in Oxford, but we're of Pakistani heritage. So, so she's always been that sort of rock of the family. And then suddenly when she went through her hormonal changes, and she actually went through her menopause age 55, she was a much older woman because she'd had all of those children. So having more children means that you go through it a little bit later. And she became this woman who wouldn't lock the bathroom door. She needed the door open because she was getting panics and anxiety. She'd go out in the snow because she was getting hot flushes. And so this is not the woman or not the mother that I knew. And yes, she's got a lot of other medical issues, but, you know, dementia just started to accelerate. I felt her memory, her sharpness. She's always been amazing at maths. You know, I used to think that if she'd grown up in this country, you know, she would have been, sort of top of her game in whatever she did. And I often think of myself like her. So I really did not want to go down that route of losing or not being able to remember things or not being able to work, not being able to concentrate and focus. And for me, it was more the brain side of things that really pushed me or wanted me to do this.
I think it really affects your self-esteem when you start to forget middle names, what you're doing, where you're going, and words for things. I've got a friend who just went to the doctor and said, I think something wrong with my brain because I can't remember any words. And he said, well, you're 48. This is a part of your perimenopausal journey.
And 48 is young. You know, I feel I couldn't have continued as a doctor, really. I think if I hadn't gone into HRT when I did, I worry that maybe I would not have been able to function as a doctor. I wouldn't I've been able to open my clinic. I wouldn't have been able to, you know, help other women, I suppose. I think it's really important to understand that, you know, midlife is not over. It can be a new beginning. And we've still got another, you know, 40 years or if not more ahead of us.
Mm-hmm. Lots more adventures.
Yeah.
Can we go back to vaginas?
Yes, I was going to say. I wanted to talk about sex life.
Sex life. And you mentioned as well vaginal health, which I'm not sure is something that we think about a lot either. And I mean, I have talked to women who have various problems with their vaginas since...
Why do you do that funny thing when you say vagina?
I don't know, it's that word, isn't it? you've actually got a laser treatment that you do at your clinic. Can you just talk us through what it does and what it can help with?
It gives you a laser to use from your vagina, is that what you're saying? Because I think that would be really bloody useful.
We talk about vaginal health, and I think we forget, actually, that vaginal health isn't just sexual health. It can also be your pelvic floor. One of the things that a lot of women start to get in their perimenopause and onwards is recurrent urinary tract infections, recurrent thrush. And the reason that happens is because our protective barrier, pH, acidic barrier changes, and that's also because of declining estrogen. So what the laser does is it sort of heats up the vaginal lining. It does little micro traumas. So what it does is helps to tighten the vagina. It also helps to produce more collagen. So it helps with lubrication and helping support the pelvic floor. And it's something that women who can't go onto HRT, like, for example, breast cancer survivors, who are often on treatments that really dry them out, you know, dry out their skin, as well as, you know, vaginal dryness, it can help with that. So,
How does it work? Where do you put it?
It's a laser. It looks a bit like it's a probe, and I'm going to be blunt. It looks like a dildo, you know, and you insert it inside the vagina. It's a short sort of treatment period. You know, not really painful at all. And it's not like having a smear test. So it's quite a nice, easy way of doing it, you know, sort of, and helping women. Because I often think, you know, breast cancer survivors in particular, they're made to feel so grateful for having their breast cancer treatment, they've forgotten that they're also women. And, you know, we're going back to sex again. It's important in love, in intimacy.
And, sorry, vaginas again.
She's got a list.
Yeah, a vagina list.
A friend told me that her doctor said that her vagina had atrophied.
Yeah.
What does that mean? It didn't sound very good.
No, it's not a nice word. No. And what atrophied means is that lining of the womb has thinned. So it's not as plump as it used to be. Okay. And because of that, it's a bit drier. And when you're having sex, it can be painful and uncomfortable. So often when your vagina atrophies, the walls of the vagina thin, it can also shorten a little bit. So that's why it's important to use your vagina, because having an orgasm, having sex, increases that blood flow to it and really helps with the sort of the natural tissues down there. So I say use it or lose it.
That's a good place
that's
to end
what,
on.
Yeah, let's use. That's what Trish and I'll be doing this afternoon. Using our vaginas. Right. Shall we talk about what happens when you argue with your teenagers? Because this is, I mean, it's just really tricky, isn't it? I'm a bit of a shouter. As you know, I come from a family, you have a big argument, it's all over in 10 seconds, it's all very loud, and we just move on. There was a survey last year of 1,000 children aged 8 to 11, and 10% of them said that they really need things to be much calmer during argument situations. But that aside, the thing that made me laugh out of the whole, one of the little kids said that actually they thought it'd be better if Alexa or Google Home was shouting at the argument than...
if they were going to have an argument with something,
they'd rather have an argument with an inanimate computer robotic voice, because that they could get their point across and feel listened to. So it's such a difficult thing,
isn't it,
with teenagers.
I mean, looking back, I thought I'd sort of think about how I was as a teenager and rowing with my parents, and I didn't. And the reason I didn't is because I had an older sister who did an awful, awful lot of it. Bless her. She sort of, you know, led the way and did all the rowing on behalf, because we're only a year apart. So she sort of did all the rowing on behalf of both of us. And I just thought, this really doesn't work out very well. So I just decided my approach would be that I just wouldn't really tell my parents anything. And I ended up being an enormous sneak. So I just go off and sneakily do things.
So
rather
you were
than
lying,
actually,
not rowing.
I was lying, not rowing. And actually thinking about that now, it just means, thinking about that with my children, I would hate them to not tell me what they were doing, and I'd hate to not know. So I'd rather listen. It's about negotiation, isn't it? It's where the thing is, when they become teenagers, we're so used to controlling everything in their life up until that age, about 12 or 13. Then suddenly they want to take control of it. It's their life. They want to make the decisions. So really, it's about a negotiation between the two. So it's a kind of
It's also
diplomatic negotiation. It's not about parents always being right or having the final say.
I've spoken to quite a few psychologists and experts for my parenting column in Sunday Times magazine. And one of the things that I think I've learned is that during your teenage, when you're going through quite a lot of neurological changes, it's very difficult for teenagers to process negative words. So it might be logical and sensible to you, but they physically can't hear it or translate it into meaning. So you're both arguing from a different standpoint at that point. And often it's not what you're rowing about that's the issue. It's a long running thing happening underneath. And you have to practice what they call active listening. You're in argument mode. So you're thinking about what you're going to say next. What you're not doing is taking that 2 or 3 seconds to really listen to what they might be saying underneath.
It's quite hard, isn't it, stopping yourself when you're in the moment?
Yes.
How do you stop yourself?
You could try the ABC method, which an author of a teenage help book taught me, which I think is obvious, but, you know, it's good to have it set in your mind and get it as a habit. So A is for accept. So you're in the room, all this is kicking off, there's loads of shouting, everyone hates you. So just accept that there's loads of anger and emotion in the room. Take a moment and think, here it is, all this awfulness happening in front of me. B is breathe. So just take a very deep breath. That resets your brain slightly. And then C is choice. So you think, shall I yell or not? You actually ask yourself that question. Am I going to yell here or not? If you're they're wrong.
I just feel awful afterwards.
No, it's wrong. On every level, it's wrong to hate myself for not having
been able to do that, take the breath and just kind of, and think, okay, what is this really about? Does it really matter? Does it warrant a row? Because quite often does it, you know, if it's about messy bedrooms or, I mean, we don't really row about that stuff. These are kind of given up on that, but it's, there
safety
are
safety is yeah, the thing yeah. to row. So if you think that, or they've done something truly diabolical, but even in those circumstances, any which way you cut it, you must not shout at them. You can tell them exactly how you feel, but you must keep the volume down and you need to say it slowly and you need to make sure they are listening at this point. If they're not listening and you're all shouting, there's just no point. There's no point doing
it. No, and I think what's sort of recommended in those situations is like having a time out and saying...
Everyone having one.
Everyone having a time out, because even sort of saying something like, okay, let's leave this now. You can calm down. I'm going to go away and gather my thoughts and I'm going to really think about this. Because if they hear, they want you to know that you're listening to them and you're thinking about what they're saying. So if you can kind of, I mean, that's very grown up way of doing it and it's not always easy in the moment, but I think that's something I have been trying and it does seem to work quite well. And then, you know, going back, having thought about it, and quite often I think in the heat of a moment, if you start asking quite practical things, it sort of diffuses it because it stops them being in this kind of rah. So if it's about a party, you can start saying, well, okay, what time is the party or what time? And then they have to stop and think and answer, and that can kind of
slows
diffuse
it.
And what about humour? Do you ever use humour to diffuse?
I'm 0 to 10 on the rage front, so it's quite difficult to then try and find some funny in between. Another thing I'd learnt was to say I rather than you. So when you have the argument, you say, I feel that, rather than you always, which is a really awful thing to say. And then there's a psychologist in America called Dr. Brad Reedy, R-E-E-D-Y. And one of the things he points out in his book is we often walk into the room with all our own psychological makeup and every way we've ever argued with our own parents. And what we're kind of expecting, even if it's subconscious, is for our children and our teenagers to make us better, to make us feel better. This is a terrible thing they've done. It's made us feel awful. We know it's wrong that they've done it. We need to feel better. And that's a massive responsibility to put on a young brain, a young, emotionally immature adolescent. To ask them to make you feel better is wrong. That's not, and it might even be a subconscious thing you're doing, but that's just not fair. So you really have to step away from the emotions on it and think, what needs to physically be done or sorted or resolved? Where do I want the end point of this to be? And the end point can't be, it makes me feel a better parent.
No.
That's not their responsibility.
It's about us being compassionate to them, isn't it? And understanding that, you know, they're rowing or they're behaving this way because there's something that's upsetting them. And quite often, the thing that you're rowing about isn't the thing,
no,
is it? There might
no.
be some underlying issue. And sometimes a row might be the only time that they can actually tell you what they're really thinking or feeling. Because they don't feel listened to. Or they want to talk about something, then they don't know how to talk about it. So off it goes.
Do you sulk?
I'm not a sulker. I'm a bit of a door slammer. If I do kick off, I kick off. It doesn't happen very often. And I might huff and then bang a door, which is so immature.
I'm a bit of a swearer.
Is interesting because
it's
what
bad.
Would you swear? You would swear in the what
in,
if they
I wouldn't swear at them?
No, not but right. Okay, yeah, not at them.
But, I do swear at the dog though.
Right,
I swear at her.
But what
She's
if they swear
the
at you? What would you? Or if they kind
they
of were really disrespectful?
But what is disrespectful? So that's the you view it as such. But
and
in
if
their
they called
heads,
you
do they think
effing bitch?
Oh, that would
some
be.
I mean, my
bad.
Kids haven't done that, but some people's kids will do that.
Yeah, the heated, very heated moment. Well, I think that is disrespectful, but the kind of just sort of when they say whatever or sucks to be you, that kind of thing. That's that's not disrespectful. I think we all have to work out what our levels are. Some of these are very, very obvious.
Yeah. And it's the thing you would talk about them afterwards when they're in a good place and when they're sort of in, you can bring it up then in a very calm and measured and say how
we know the rule about
hurt.
That, don't we?
What's
side by side,
oh,
never
face
to face. Never have a face
to face. Find them when they're kind of, you know, when they're in a good place and they're enjoying chatting with you. I mean, I think they'd be mortified by that kind of buffet, or they can be.
Do you know what's brilliant about teenagers, though, which I absolutely love, is when they have a real strong view about something politically or something they think that shouldn't be happening. Climate change, we have so many arguments about that because they're quite impractical in there and they do blame
us. So they're quite idealistic, but then they're like, leave the tap running, that sort of stuff.
Exactly, yeah. They're like the biggest users of single-use plastic, but they'll make a right fuss about Australia being on fire, quite rightly. But their kind of self-righteous belief in themselves, I find that really lovely. I love hearing them. I love it when they come back at me with that
idealism
passion.
It's really good.
It's not all bad.
No, it's not. And I read a statistic that apparently teenagers argue with their parents, i.e. us, as much as couples do in the breakdown of a relationship.
Oh, I see.
So that kind of gives you an idea. So anybody out there having a lot of rows, it's not abnormal.
Not just you.
Yeah, and they're not going to divorce you.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
So now we've come to that bit of the episode right towards the end where we talk about the things that we've been doing and that have been inspiring us this week. So what's changed your life this week, Lorraine?
Can I tell you what's changed my life? And it's been, honestly, it made me cry. It made me laugh. It put me into such a place when I was watching it one Sunday afternoon. Cheer on Netflix. It's a documentary of the Navajo cheerleading team. Every cheerleader in it has an extraordinary backstory. And Monica, the coach, I would die for Monica. I would walk into oncoming traffic for that woman.
Goodness.
She is amazing. She takes these kids from the worst background and they're national champions in the States. And it's their story leading up to the national championship. And it's just, and it's also all the things I love is cheerleading, which is gymnastics. Brilliant music.
I'm going home and watching that tonight.
I loved it so much.
That's it.
Other thing I've been trying this week, which I've discovered a little noodly googly, is Etsy's 1980s gifts strand. All the things. They've got all the games
we used to play. Like what?
You remember Mastermind with those funny little pegs?
Yes!
There's that.
Yes.
There's Smurfs. It's got everything. It's got all the kind. It's got I bought an ET key ring. Well, I don't need one of them, do
I? No, you don't.
Why have I got that?
No. That's not going to save the
Took
planet.
Took me back in time. No. And then I had a little nostalgia moment when my teenager came in Friday night on her way out with her boyfriend, 17 years old, came in wearing some fantastic trousers. And I went, oh, God, look at your parachute pants. They're fabulous. What is the point of you? She said. Why are you talking? What do you mean parachute? I said, they're parachute trousers. They're made of different bits of material. That's parachute trousers. That's from the 90s.
Did you have a lot of pairs?
I had lots of parachute trousers. There she was wearing, absolutely horrified.
Well, you know what you need to do is borrow them and wear them the next time she's there with her boyfriend. She'll be even more horrified.
Yes. Look at me wearing your clothes.
Your clothes.
I knew you'd like that, Sky. I knew you'd like it.
Oh.
What's been going on in your life?
Well,
what are you testing and trying?
Do you know, well, I tell you what's changed my life this week, or more that just literally stunned me, was I was having a little chat on the phone with my dad, as you do, and he is 80 years old. He's
a
lovely Irishman from the west of Ireland, you know, loves watching rugby and drinking Guinness. And he said, oh, I've been to yoga this morning.
Don't be ridiculous, you misheard.
That's what I said. I said, no, Dad, no, I didn't go to yoga. I went swimming. I told you I went swimming. And he went, no, 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 I went to yoga. He started doing yoga at 80. And he's also tried Pilates.
as he called it.
What, video?
No, Pilates.
He's gone
in
out
a class.
The house,
Pilates, yeah. Pilates.
He must be one of the few men in the class, no?
Yeah, he said there's three old guys and a bunch of women. So, but I'm just like, my goodness, I am stunned. That's brilliant.
Well done, Dad.
Can I do a foodie one for what I'm trying? I've slightly become, and I know this isn't new, but I'm obsessed with coconut yogurt. It's so delicious. And I've got
you
this.
You know how I feel about coconuts.
New breakfasty thing that I whiz up. I've got one of those little mini blenders, bought that, that's amazing. Whiz up some coconut yogurt with some chia seeds, frozen berries.
Oh, for God's
sake.
Oh,
my God, it's delicious. It's delicious. And then if you really want to go down, a bit of toasted coconut flakes on top. So
I disagree.
Would you not bother?
Coconut. Oh, I can't even smell it. I can't have it anywhere. It's a bit like beetroot for me.
Oh, no.
Coconut.
I love both of those things.
That's why
we're yin and yang. And then just my nostalgia thing is my twins are about to turn 16 and they're getting very excited about the fact that it's only a year until they can start doing driving lessons. And it took me back to, I did my driving test at 17. Can't believe that. That's amazing. And my first car was a Renault 5. Do you remember Renault
5? I had a Fiat 127.
Oh, I loved it.
You know I'm a terrible driver, don't you? People say it's like getting in a roller coaster.
Ah,
yeah,
okay.
Dreadful. So. I once drove into the back of a post office van on the Waterloo roundabout. I was brushing my hair. I just can't hold my concentration long enough to drive anywhere. Terrible, terrible driver.
Like anyway, my lovely Renault 5.
Did you name it, Trish?
I did actually. I should have done, shouldn't I?
Sometimes people
maybe I didn't love it enough.
No.
Anyway.
Just like... That's it for today. Thank you very much for listening to Postcards from Midlife.
Next time, we'll be talking to Louise Wenner about feeling desired in your sexuality when you're approaching or in your midlife.
We'd love you to get in touch and tell us what you want us to cover in future episodes. You can follow us on Instagram, Postcards from Midlife, or you can follow us personally at Sunday Times Lorraine or at Trish of the Day. If you like what you're hearing between me and this silly sausage opposite me there, could you rate and comment on whichever platform you subscribe to your podcast?
See you next time.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.